quite off the beam when he wrote this article. So I responded to him, and I'd like to read my response to David Limbaugh. First of all, not all dissenters are equal. Some genuine believe that Emperor Bush and his gang of corporate thugs have failed to prove any significant connection between Saddam Hussein and 9/11, or that Saddam represents a clear and present danger to America to the point of going to war. Secondly, there is a world of difference between supporting America and the government, which is whatever regime happens to presently be in place in power. I think you and your brother, that would be Rush Limbaugh, are knowingly or unknowingly in major denial of how big money has corrupted our Constitution. America had a coup d'etat in 63 in which a cabal of plutocrats took over the country and have been running it into the ground ever since. So far, they brought us Vietnam, death squads in Central and South America, and Gulf War I, and now Gulf War II. Our foreign policy the last 50 years has not been dictated by Washington's friendship with all, alliance with none, but rather most often by simple greed that employs murder, among many things, to achieve its end. It is not easy for a loyal American, which I consider myself to be, to face, realize, and admit how corrupt, lying, and indeed murderous their government has become, but such is the case. Our government now is a government of the money, by the money, and for the money. The final nail in America's freedom coffin will be when Bush succeeds in blanketing America with the new electronic voting counting machines, untraceable and unaccountable elections, made to order. Again, in this matter, you and your brother's silence is deafening. As far as I can see, Emperor Bush et al. Seems to be doing everything in their power to destroy America and the Constitution, especially the Bill of Rights. In conclusion, please wipe the fog off your government glasses and remember that a patriot is not someone who's trying to overthrow the government, but rather trying to stop the government from overthrowing the Constitution. America is in grave peril, and the danger is primarily from within. Yours truly. Good evening, caller. You're on the airwaves. Oh, excuse me. No, you're not. If you'll just hold there. So, if you have any comments on that, you're welcome to call. The call-in number is 464-8295. This is Tom Clooney. I'm here every Monday evening from 7 to 8. Well, here's another follow-up article on this. Sweden offers free speech refuge to United States officials. And basically what Sweden has done is taken up Bush on his own program. Bush challenged officials in the Iraqi government, if they really wanted to tell the truth, that the United States government would protect them. Well, Sweden says, well, let's do that the same for America. So Sweden has offered for CIA officials and others to come over to Sweden, and Sweden government would take them and their families and set them up and allow them to speak freely. So here's one fellow, Blaine Williams, the former CIA analyst from America, has gone over there, and now he's just talking his head off, talking about how in the Bush administration that he was not allowed to speak freely, and the same with so many of his colleagues. If they said anything that was in contradiction to the current line, that their jobs were in dire jeopardy. And he says, I can assure you that no one at CIA believes a word Bush said. What's more, no one at CIA believes that Bush believes a word that Bush says. Well, folks, I think we're definitely on the edge of war here. I really don't see them going up to the edge and then backing off. I've never seen the CFR types do any such things. Usually when they come this far to go in the war, there's no stopping them. And it's a very sad situation. I think a lot of people are going to lose their lives, and it's I think it's a very sad day, and it will continue to be so. So the only thing we can do is I think, offer our prayers and our hopes and best wishes. I don't condemn the soldiers over there. I see them as much victims as the average American taxpayer here and the average Iraqi. So I will see you again next Monday at 7 o'clock. Thank you. This has been Tom Cloney.
Stan here at Radio Liberty, coming from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story. Hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that's going to determine what the future will bring. I have to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of this station. They happen to be my views, the views of our guests, the views of our callers. And, of course, we welcome your calls from out across America at 1-888-24-LIBERTY or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. But please hold your calls for the time being. We have with us on the line Dr. Garth Nicholson. Now, Dr. Nicholson is with the Institute of Molecular Medicine. Previously, he held several professorial positions at the MD Anderson Clinic in Texas. And, of course, for reasons we will not necessarily discuss, he left there. He was a tenured professor, so you can't fire a tenured professor, but there were some, well, perhaps Dr. Nicholson may want to address that at some time. But he came to California. He has over 550 peer-reviewed articles, which is almost unheard of in this day and age. And he's on the editorial board of a number of various publications and edits several publications on his own. But he has, of course, been very interested in Gulf War illness and these chronic infections that are really wreaking such havoc on people today. And, of course, we'll be talking with him on lots of issues this evening. Dr. Nicholson, thank you so much for being with us.
Well, it's a pleasure to be on your show again.
Well, of course, you there at the Institute of Molecular Medicine have an opportunity really to do pretty much what you want to in the way of research. And I think maybe what we ought to do is perhaps talk to our listeners a little bit about the Gulf War syndrome. Certainly our audience up in the Northwest, Spokane, there are four radio stations up there that will hear this hour. And of course, I think we should learn something from the tragedy of the last Gulf War. Hopefully we will not have problems again this time. But how many of our servicemen, there were about 700,000 Americans who went over to the Gulf War in 1990 and 1991. And of course, although we lost very, very few men in battle, we've lost an awful lot of men, both ill and certainly chronically. Some of them have even died as a result of coming back. And these were young, healthy men when they went over there. Do we have any idea how many people, how many of our servicemen are ill from the Gulf War?
Well, ill, there's been between 150,000 and 200,000 have registered for benefits through the VA. The reports on deaths are harder to find because that number is classified, but we've heard from our friends within the Pentagon itself that the number, at least a couple of years ago, was at least 28,000.
Well, that's a frightening figure because, of course, men this young ordinarily, actuarially can't die. That's why we can have insurance companies can insure people for, you know, $1 million for a very, very small amount of money because people don't die at this age group. except very rarely, and yet so many of these people have died. What sort of things do people with Gulf War illness actually die of?
Well, they die of a variety of different conditions, and some die actually because of their increased risk of accidents. In fact, there have been two or three studies on this, and they have a much increased rate of accidents. So that's one of the suicide is also way high out of proportion compared to their age group. Just practically in every category, diseases, fatal diseases, for example, suicides, accidents, practically every category you could look at, there are much higher incidence of the rate of death.
Now, of course, what about ALS, Lou Gehrig's disease?
Well, we were very interested in Lou Gehrig's disease because, again, there were so many more cases of Lou Gehrig's disease in the Gulf War veterans than one would anticipate from their age group. Again, most of these were in their early 20s, the average age, early 20s of the deployed forces. And we don't actually even know the true number of ALS patients, but we know that already the studies that have been done, and it's way out of proportion to the population in general. And we've actually just published a study in a neurologic journal on this because we've been very interested in the role of chronic infections in at least the progression of ALS and possibly even in the inception of ALS. And what we found is that 100% of the Gulf War veterans had a very unusual infection that we found in other Gulf War veterans. And we wondered why the percentage was so high in ALS. That is, virtually everyone that we tested, and these were British, American, and Australian veterans, so it didn't really matter what country they were from. What did matter was that they received vaccines during deployment, and that seems to be the critical issue, not only with these patients with ALS, but also with other Gulf War veterans that were deployed. And in the ALS group, there were actually two different infections. One was a unusual bacterium called a mycoplasma, which is a small, very small bacterium that doesn't have a cell wall, so it gets inside our cells, and there it can hide from the immune system and cause all kinds of havoc. And particularly when it gets in the central nervous system. Now, ALS is a disease that's characterized by degeneration of the motor neurons in the central nervous system. So actually in our brain stem, we have motor neurons that control things like our breathing and swallowing and so on. And these are the motor neurons that get attacked by ALS. And it's a pretty horrible death. When people die of ALS, essentially their breathing is affected, even their swallowing, of course, their movements, other body movements and so on. So it's a pretty tragic ending to their lives. We found actually two infections in almost 100% of the patients. One is an unusual viral infection that targets the central nervous system, and another is this unusual mycoplasma or bacteria that also targets the central nervous system. So this may be a combination which is very important in this type of disease. We've also found similar infections in other diseases, like MS, for example, and other neurodegenerative diseases. So this is not an uncommon thing, and we don't know why the particular genetic makeup and maybe a particular combination of different infections leads to ALS, where in other patients they get slightly different combination of infections, and this might direct them to MS. MS, or multiple sclerosis, is a little bit different from ALS in that in MS it's more of an autoimmune disease, and it's actually the sheath or the insulation around the nerves are actually destroyed in the process of MS. And so the insulation, when that's gone, then the nerves are not insulated any longer and they're not protected, and of course then this causes major problems in terms of nerve conduction. So it's a different process.
Well, now, does the mycoplasma, is this pretty much one type of mycoplasma, or is it any type of mycoplasma, or is this this specific type of mycoplasma that you found so prevalent within the Gulf War veterans?
Well, in any chronic disease, we find these types of infections at very high rates, but in the Gulf War, there was a particular species, and almost every patient had this species called Mycoplasma fermentans. And we don't see that as commonly in the civilians that have a variety of different conditions, including ALS, for example. There are other species that seem to be involved. So in the Gulf War veterans, there's a very distinctive type of disease that's associated with this particular infection. And it's called Gulf War illness. And, of course, there's subsets of Gulf War illness with other problems, chemical exposures and other infections that can then progress to other known diseases. But Gulf War illness is kind of a catch-all because these were kind of nondescript illnesses. We know them in the civilian population as chronic fatigue syndrome and fibromyalgia syndrome, but in the Gulf War veterans, those diagnoses weren't allowed for many years. They're now allowed now. In fact, we caused quite a ruckus about this when we published a paper in 1996 on 650 veterans with Gulf War illness, showing that their signs and symptoms were almost exactly the same as chronic fatigue syndrome and fibromyalgia syndrome. So they've loosened up a little bit on the diagnosis of Gulf War illness, which previously was called Gulf War syndrome, which is kind of a misnomer because there's not really a new syndrome. I mean, we can see the parallel diseases within the civilian population, but they're allowing diagnoses of chronic fatigue syndrome and fibromyalgia syndrome now for the first time. For many of those veterans who received really non-diagnosis or an undiagnosable illness, this is a step forward because it allows them to have certain treatment possibilities, whereas before they were usually put in the psychiatric category. They were given diagnosis of post-traumatic stress disorder or some psychosomatic diagnosis, and this really only allowed them to be put under psychotropic drugs and mood-altering drugs. And, of course, they never recovered from their condition on these mood-altering drugs because that really wasn't their problem.
All right. Now, Kirsten, will the Veterans Administration allow them to be treated with antibiotics today?
In general, no. But in certain VA hospitals, yes, because they've been following our protocol in some places. And, in fact, there are some brave physicians in the VA that purposely give the Gulf War veterans a diagnosis like sinusitis, for example, so that they can actually prescribe long-term antibiotics. And this is really what's required to treat this type of infection, along with immune support and a number of different supplements that we found helps these veterans quite a bit. So these are things that are politically incorrect. There's kind of a checkered past for the particular microorganism that we found, Mycoplasma fermentans. The background in this is kind of sketchy, but the Army worked on this for years. In fact, they hold the only patent on this microorganism. So one of the political problems after the Gulf War was we were finding 40% of the veterans who were sick had this infection, including their symptomatic family members. And this was, of course, denied for many years, but now it's finally not denied. And they were coming down sick, and all of this was being denied and everything. And one of the reasons we felt that this was going on because of the fact that the U.S. Army was the principal researcher on this particular organism. They held the patent on it, so they knew what was going on. They knew from the Gulf War what was going on. In fact, some of the first veterans that came back and got sick were actually treated appropriately by the Department of Defense while they were still active duty soldiers. And we have some letters on our website, for example, from a retired major in the 3rd Armored Division who was treated that way. And they told them to shut up about it and never mention it, just take treatment and don't say anything about it. So they knew what was going on.
In other words, they knew, but they were not going to, of course, let the public know. They certainly were not going to allow the majority of these unfortunate young men to be treated. Before we get away from the ALS or Lou Gehrig's disease, could you perhaps talk, you mentioned a virus. What's the virus that is infecting them?
Well, one of the viruses, and it may not be the only one, is related to poliovirus. And that's probably all I need to say about it without getting too technical.
All right.
But it's called an ECHO 7 virus. And this type of virus is a neurotropic virus like poliovirus. It goes in and infects the cells in the central nervous system, and eventually those cells can become sick. And I think it's a 1-2 punch if also the mycoplasma is there, the cells had it. It kills the cells. And this is the process of ALS. It's actually a cell death process where the cells just simply degenerate and die. And it's not an autoimmune process like we have in multiple sclerosis.
All right, fine. So the point that you're making is that at least many of the Gulf War illnesses and certainly apparently some of the ALS patients seem to respond to treatment. I understand that you had done a series of treatments on the some of the ALS patients that did very well. But, of course, you were only able to do it for, what, a few months? And then after you stopped the treatment, while the patients began to regress?
Well, we had a pilot trial that we ran, and we couldn't really follow up on this because it was very expensive, and we just couldn't afford to do it. And we had about 30-plus patients enrolled in this pilot trial where they were given intravenous antibiotics and antivirals at the same time. They were also given some immune supplements and so on. And these patients actually did quite well for a while. We arrested progression in most of the patients. Other patients, actually, there was a reversal of their conditions. We had, for example, a couple of patients who couldn't walk that could regain the ability to walk. There was a patient who couldn't speak who regained the ability to speak. There was a patient who couldn't swallow and regained the ability to swallow, and so on. The problem was the trial only ran for 8 weeks, and we knew that that wasn't long enough, but we just didn't have funds to continue it any longer than that, and that was the length of time that the trial was approved. So when the trial ended, everything was fine for many of the patients, but then within a month or two, they started progressing again, and we knew that they needed to go back on therapy, but we just didn't have the funding to restart them on therapy.
Well, now, do the patients need intravenous therapy, or can they do fairly well just on oral drugs like doxycycline?
Well, for some of the antibiotics like doxycycline, oral seems to be fine. It does pass the blood-brain barrier and get into the central nervous system, but we were using a particular antiviral with it that had to be administered intravenously, one that would target this polio-like virus. So because of that, we really had to use intravenous therapy a couple of times a day. And this presented a real problem because we had to have main lines in these people to administer IVs twice a day and so on. So it was a very expensive and difficult procedure to do this over a long period of time.
Well, now, Kirsten, your suggestion to people with these chronic infections is to build up the immune system. Could we perhaps talk a little bit about that? Because, of course, most people are not going to be able to get the sort of treatment that you're suggesting, and certainly it isn't advocated mainline, at least not at the present time. It's such a tragedy that the funds are not available. But I feel probably as time goes by and we see the real attack on the economy here in the United States and, what we're doing with Medicare now, we're going to give free drugs to a lot of people, and that's even going to be another nail in the coffin of our public health programs. And I think increasingly people are going to have to begin thinking about how they're going to take care of themselves and build up their own immune system. And you've really gone into that in great detail on your website. Would you like to tell our listeners the conclusions you've come to about how we would build up our own immune response so we wouldn't be so susceptible to these chronic infections?
Well, this is a major problem that we face these days, particularly in our polluted environment and with the things that we're exposed to. Our immune systems are quite naturally run down and deteriorate over time. And it's a natural process of aging as well. So we need to find ways to boost our immune system and to keep it young, more or less. And there are a number of different procedures to do this, and we have some recommendations on our website for doing that. There's no one particular regimen that works best for everyone. People are individuals, and so there's some different things that they need to try to find out what works best for them. And that's one of the problems. And recommending these natural supplements and so on is that they don't work uniformly for everybody. So you have to try a number of different things to see what works best for you and your system. But if they go to our website, which is www.immed.org, it's like immediate.org, they can find their answers to some of these questions about supplements. And we'll go on and talk a little bit more about this because there are some natural supplements, not in the immune-boosting area, but in other types of immune supplements that really enhance a person's well-being. They actually reverse the aging process, if you can believe that, at least in terms of the chemistry of the cell. And we've just completed two clinical trials on this, and I'd like to talk further about this because these can be used by anybody. They can be obtained by anybody. These are food supplements, natural food supplements, and so on. And they're combinations of antioxidants to reverse the damage to our cells and essentially lipid replacement along with that to replace the damaged lipids in our cells. And these are two very important things that we must do when we age because the damage due to oxidation accumulates during aging and may actually be the cause of it.
And, of course, by oxidation, you mean, of course, it's sort of like the rusting of the cells, of this oxidation eventually begins to destroy the cell itself, doesn't it?
It does, and in fact, it destroys the enzymes. It inactivates the enzymes in our cells. It causes mutation of the DNA or the genetic information in the cell It causes damage of the lipids, which form the membrane barrier around the cell, and also all the important organelles in the cell. And one organelle that I'm going to talk a little bit about, which has a very important relationship to fatigue, is the mitochondria. And this is a little organelle that's like our battery in our cell. Every cell has a bunch of these little organelles called mitochondria. And inside the mitochondria are the energy systems of the cell. These are the systems that convert metabolically molecules into energy that are stored inside the cell and can be used for a number of different synthetic functions in the cell.
All right, fine. And, of course, I know that Don Scott I've talked to, and he has some of these reports, government reports that came out, and mentioned how the mycoplasm could interfere with the mitochondria. Is there any relationship to that?
Oh, absolutely. And this is the reason we got involved in that in the first place, because these mycoplasmal infections cause fatigue. And fatigue is the most common complaint of all patients seeking general medical care in the United States, Canada, and Great Britain, and other countries.
All right, we're going to have to take a quick break here. We'll be back in just a moment with our special guest, Dr. Garth Nicholson. Well, our guest this evening is Dr. Garth Nicholson, and we're talking about, of course, the chronic infections that are really seem to be the basis of the chronic fatigue syndrome, the fibromyalgia, as an adjunct to that, the Gulf War illness that plagues so many people in America today. And I can remember as a young doctor practicing, and I'd never heard of chronic fatigue syndrome. Oh, I'd had some people coming in and, tired, housewife tired, mothers with five children tired. But certainly not the fibromyalgia, the people with multiple aches and pains, people that have some sort of an accident, maybe that have a rear-end collision, would come in with a whiplash. But it wasn't simply a sore neck. They hurt all over. And, you hear this story the first time, and even as I begin to get older in the practice of medicine, I'd say, this can't be real. I mean, nobody hurts all over because, of course, their neck hurts. It's just they've got to be a little crazy. And it's only really as time has gone by that, and looking back on some of these patients, that I realized that they were really presenting with these clinical entities, because what happens is when a trauma comes along, and if you do have these latent infections, sometimes this can flare this up and the whole system begins to decompensate and you hurt all over and you're chronically tired, you can't get out of bed. And for the doctor who's not acquainted with this, why, of course, they've got to be putting this on. Nobody ever hurt this much simply from getting a rear-end collision. Have you run into that sort of situation?
Very commonly. That's one of the most common complaints for the onset of the illness, was that, I got in an automobile accident or had a severe trauma, and I was in the hospital for a while, and then within a few months of that, all of a sudden I developed this chronic fatiguing condition, and then it sort of evolved into either fibromyalgia, as you mentioned, which is when your muscles are very achy and painy and you have very tender spots on your body, or just chronic fatigue syndrome, which is the major complaint is of course fatigue, but then there are a series of other complaints, and there are a number of other signs and symptoms that go along with this, so it's not just fatigue. But one of the important aspects of all these chronic illnesses is fatigue. So we were interested in that because it does seem to involve the mitochondria, as we were talking about before. And recently, we've actually started to look at mitochondrial function. And what we found was really very interesting. Patients with these chronic illnesses that show fatigue show diminished mitochondrial function. So if you actually go in and measure the capacity of their mitochondria from a blood sample to produce energy, they're impaired. And they may not be completely impaired, but they're impaired, usually 20 to 50%. And that's significant when you think about the cells having to rely on mitochondria to produce almost all the energy stores within our cells. So if you have your mitochondria undergoing dysfunction to that degree, then you're going to be fatigued. So one of the things that we started doing recently was to try and reverse this process. Now, one of the things that we were mentioning before that affects mitochondria is oxidation. So one of the ways to prevent that are antioxidants. But that's not the whole problem, because if things are damaged, they have to be replaced. So we started using a supplement that actually replaces the lipids of the mitochondria. It's a special supplement that's made by a company in New York called Propex, P-R-O-P-A-X. And by the way, you can find this by going to www.propex.com. And we've done two clinical trials now using this product and showing that it will increase the mitochondrial function either in ill patients or in aged patients.
I'm going to have to interrupt you in just a moment. We'll be back. Just have to take a momentary break. Well, this is Dr. Stan here, and our special guest this evening is Dr. Garth Nicholson. He was talking about a product that seems to be able to help people who have this chronic fatigue syndrome. Their mitochondria are not working well, and the mitochondria, the little batteries that are in the cells, that they're not working properly, you just have a chronic fatigue problem. But he was sending something called Propax. And is this a dietary supplement, or what is it?
It is. It's a dietary supplement. It contains the mitochondrial lipids and antioxidants and some vitamins and minerals and so on. So it's a pretty complete package in terms of those or other sorts of things that one needs. And what it does is it replaces the damaged lipids in the mitochondria. Now, the reason that's important is that the mitochondria, if you think of them, again, as little batteries, they have lipid layers around them, and that's mainly for insulation. Because the part of the energy process in the mitochondria requires that there be an electrical gradient in the mitochondria. And if you damage the lipids, you lose that gradient. It's kind of like stripping the insulation off a battery. The battery runs down. Same idea. You've got to insulate what goes on inside the mitochondria. And if the insulation's damaged, then you can't do that. And it doesn't function as well as it should. And once you start replacing the damaged lipids, then all of a sudden we found that the function, even of somebody who's 70, 80 years old, can return to a 20-year-old's ability to generate the energy in the mitochondria. And all of a sudden, wham, their fatigue all of a sudden starts to go away. And this all happens within about 30 to 60 days after being on the supplement. You can see the parallels very nicely between mitochondrial function and loss of fatigue. And we've just completed these two studies. If people would like to see the publications that resulted from this, they're on our website under treatment, and you can actually get some information there and actually see the results of these studies. So I think it's kind of interesting what we found, and the tie-in with mitochondria is very important in a variety of chronic illnesses, because mitochondria are impaired in a variety of chronic illnesses, and this, we think, leads to part of the fatigue process. And so we're hoping that in many patients we can reverse at least that part of the disease process by allowing the mitochondria to be repaired with these lipids and preventing further damage using antioxidant molecules.
Now, is this something like vitamin C, vitamin E, zinc and selenium, or what kind
of... Well, those are some of the antioxidants that are present in this combination. Of course, these have been studied independently and together in a number of different studies over the years, and their antioxidant properties of all those compounds indicate that they're quite important to us. But it's one thing preventing the oxidation, it's another thing repairing the damage once it's occurred. And we think now that both have to happen in order to really reverse the damage process and to get the mitochondria functioning where they should be functioning and putting out energy at the level that they should be putting out energy. And then that's when the fatigue, we can see a major dent in the fatigue of either an aged individual or an individual with a chronic illness.
And this is nothing but really a nutritional supplement?
That's correct. And the interesting thing about it is they've devised a way to protect the lipids when they're taken in so they won't be oxidized in our gut. It'd be one thing just taking lipids. We bring in lipids all the time in our normal diet, but a lot of those lipids get oxidized in the process of metabolizing them and digesting them and so on and so forth. And if that happens, then that doesn't really help us at all.
All right, and so this obviously is a product, and you've actually done clinical trials as well as, certainly studied in the laboratory?
That's right. In fact, the two studies that are on the website are actual clinical trials, IRB-approved clinical trials that were done at our institution, and set up very carefully, and the endpoints are very carefully done and so on. The data was very significant, and that's why I'm reporting it tonight. And we think it's very, very important.
Well, of course, you know, there are somewhere between 800,000 and 1 million people in America with this chronic fatigue syndrome. And these are many times very capable, successful people. Suddenly they have a little minor cold or flu-like symptoms, and then suddenly they just get to the point they can't get out of bed, and it's ruined so many professions. People have been destroyed economically because they can't hold down a job. Families have broken up over this. And yet, of course, the medical profession as a whole has said, well, the chronic fatigue syndrome, it really doesn't exist. I've been to lots of medical meetings where they sort of scoffed at anybody who talked about this. Oh, yes, it's all psychological. And yet it isn't psychological, although some of this existed before, starting perhaps in the late 70s, early 1980s. Suddenly this disease was found. It was found in clusters. And we can talk a lot more about this when we get back. But right now, of course, we're going to have to go to our half-hour break. And then, of course, when we get back, our guest, Dr. Garth Nicholson, if you have a question, give us a call, 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and this is the time when I have to remind our listeners out there that Radio Liberty really is listener-supported, and we're dependent on those of you who listen to our programs. If you agree that there's a problem and you'd like to become part of the Radio Liberty family of supporters, why, give us a call at 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-5-HIV-WAR. Of course, we hope that many of you will at least want to give serious consideration to becoming a member, or if you'd like to just get a free copy of our newsletter, again, the number 1-800-544-8927. You can go up on the website, radioliberty.com. That's www.radioliberty.com, and you can pull our newsletters down there for nothing. You can actually listen to our programs live on the radio 3 hours a day there. There's a link to the American Freedom Network. There's another reference to the Genesis Network. We do a program there 3 to 4 every weekday from 3 to 4 o'clock. And of course, you can listen 5 hours a day if you want to. Won't get much of anything accomplished, but you know, at least you can, if you can't get one program, you can get another. Now, there are a number of programs that are archived. Our afternoon program, all of our Radio Liberty programs are archived and are available to you free of charge. Right there up on our website, you have our permission to copy our newsletters, to copy our certainly our radio programs, and distribute them, because the only way we're going to get any information out is, of course, by word of mouth. And I will tell you that our listening audience on the Internet is growing. It's growing at a rate, one of the highest ones. The Internet carrier we have actually has well over 100 different ministries, and we're right up at the very top as far as growth is concerned. And so that's exciting to know that people are out there and listening on a regular basis all across the country. But people learn because somebody else tells them. And a lot of people don't want to hear the truth. But if you have somebody, perhaps they have chronic fatigue syndrome, or they have somebody that has one or another type of illness, or maybe they're concerned about what's happening to our economy, or maybe they're concerned about what's happening to their children's education. There's usually something in everybody that they're concerned about. And if you could just understand what that is and perhaps interest them in beginning to look further, hopefully, as they begin to listen, they'll begin to understand that all of these problems fit together. None of them are independent. They're all interlocked in this common spiritual battle in which we're engaged, that's being fought on a political, ideological, cultural, yes, even on a medical battlefield. Well, we're going to be back here with Dr. Garth Nicholson. But right now, we have a calling in from Joe from Idaho. Hi, Joe. How are you doing?
Hey, Dr. Stan, God bless you, and God bless your guest.
All right. Now, are you a Gulf War veteran or what?
Yes, I am.
Okay, and did you have any problems with that? Did you have
I'm sorry.
No, go ahead.
Yeah, after I came back, I had a rash and so forth, and I told the doctors at my duty station, and they sort of passed it off, just like your guest said. Something that neither you, they weren't knowledgeable at the time of what all of the causes were, so they had an air of skepticism in addressing it. But in December, I was at work, and under a stressful period of time, I developed a pain on the top of my head and had it analyzed, and it turned out to be where the neurologist says I have a 25 to 35% chance now that I have MS. And I don't know if your guest knows of anything that I can do to either reverse that or stop the process from continuing.
Well, now, how long ago was it this was you told you might have MS?
January.
All right, fine. Now, do you have any neurological problem at all, other than just the pain? But I know the pain is distressing, but is there any neurological weakness or other problems that go with MS? Or have they been able to do an MRI on you to find any areas of focal neurological degeneration?
Yes, I had an MRI done in January, and in order to confirm the progress of it, I'll have to have another one done in 6 months.
Well, all right.
Between them.
Did they tell you that it showed that there were signs of
demyelinization? Yes. That's correct.
Well, let's get Dr. Garth Nicholson's expertise, because it would far exceed mine. I was an orthopedic surgeon. Dr. Nicholson's on the front lines of this. Dr. Nicholson, what about Joe's story? Have you heard anything like this before?
Oh, very common. In fact, MRI abnormalities in Gulf War veterans, I would say the majority, overwhelming majority, have these, and could be due to a number of different reasons. One of the reasons that we've been working on quite successfully is the fact that these chronic infections that we've been talking about, in particular the mycoplasma that we find in 40% of Gulf War veterans who are ill, these are neurotropic. They do pass into the central nervous system. They do cause demyelination because they set up an autoimmune attack of any cells that they reside in, and that's why many rheumatoid arthritis patients have these in their joints. But in the case of patients that have been diagnosed or even misdiagnosed with MS, they often have these in their central nervous system where they do cause havoc there. And this can result in severe pain, headaches, memory loss, variety of different neuromuscular conditions if there's demyelinization or degeneration of the nerves. So one of the things I would suggest to you is to get tested as soon as possible. There are only a couple laboratories in the country that can do those kinds of tests. One of the labs that we're recommending is actually a colleague of mine that we helped them get started in this testing process. It's called Medical Diagnostics Laboratories of Mount Laurel, New Jersey, and that's a very good lab to be tested in. There are a couple on the West Coast as well. You need to be tested particularly for Mycoplasma fermentans that is so often found in Gulf War veterans.
All right, fine. Is that found very often in the general population?
Yes, it is. But there are other mycoplasmas that are found more often than that. So the Gulf War veterans are a little bit unusual in that regard, that more than 80% of them have this one species compared to the general population, where they're mixed species of pathogenic mycoplasma and chronically ill patients. So
in the normal healthy population, what's the incidence of mycoplasma infection? People who don't, you know, they're healthy, they're just you know, they no reason for them really to go to the doctor. How frequently will they have a mycoplasma?
Well, this particular one, Mycoplasma fermentans, it's only 1 or 2%. Any type of mycoplasma at all, then it jumps up to about 8%. And we wonder what's going on in the 8% of those people. Are they carriers, or are they pre-morbid? In other words, are they going to come down later on with an illness, although they don't have it now? It's kind of a preclinical condition. There may be a variety of different things, or they may be able to withstand that type of infection and fight it off with their own immune system. We don't know the answers to that, but we do know that if you look at a normal healthy population compared to an ill population of chronically ill patients, there's a great difference. They're statistically significant. For example, in chronic fatigue patients, it's 50 to 60%. It's even higher in fibromyalgia patients in terms of the percentage of patients that you can detect these types of infections in their blood. And in their tissues, the levels are even higher, and that may be the important thing. What's in the tissues, not in the blood, but it's a very difficult process, of course, to measure levels in tissues. So we're just about limited to a blood test for these types of infections.
All right, fine. And, of course, if Joe were actually tested and he were found to have a mycoplasma fermentans, then he would be a candidate for antibiotic treatment?
Yes, he would, along with some immune support, for example, and vitamins and minerals and other supplements that will not only increase your immune system, but to help your system in general fight off these problems. And if you go to our website, a lot of this is actually discussed on our website, which again is www.immed.org. It's like immediate.org. And there's a lot of information. There are a lot of peer-reviewed publications that you can download from the site as well on this and other topics.
And I think that's really the best advice we could give you, Joe, over the air. And go to Dr. Nicholson's website, get the information. Then if you've got any questions, why, you could probably call somebody there at his laboratory.
Thank you very much.
Okay, thank you.
All right. Good night.
Okay, fine. Of course, I think that there's a lot of people out there. Now, Joe apparently has not had this for very long. We're talking about, 10 years from the Gulf War. Are people still coming down with these diseases now, 10 years later?
At an alarming rate of all kinds of different diseases, and I think that accounts for the high number of people that have succumbed and have died since the Gulf War. They have a variety of different problems. And, if we compare this to other wars, the percentage of people that are ill is really quite out of proportion to what we've seen in the Korean War, for example, or even the war in Vietnam. So we're seeing a much higher rate of illness from the Gulf War veterans.
And, of course, the one thing is that the government has not been altogether forthright with us. The government insists that there were no experimental vaccines given. And yet, of course, there are some studies that have shown that the Gulf War veterans who are ill have squalene or antibodies to squalene. Could you discuss that at all? And what is the significance of that finding?
Well, the significance is that experimental vaccines were undoubtedly used in the Gulf. And the evidence for that is that we can find antibodies against squalene in the blood. Now, squalene itself, although it's normally found in very low quantities, in our systems, in our bodies, it's really not in quantities that are large enough to elicit a strong immune response. So it's only when you use squalene as what's known as an adjuvant to help boost the immunity or the immune response that you find that antibodies present against squalene. That's one of the pieces of evidence suggesting that experimental vaccines were used. Of course, the other good piece of evidence is that some of the nurses that came back managed to slip out a few of the shot records, which they weren't supposed to do because these were all considered to be top secret now. And in those shot records, there's some obvious, coded experimental vaccines that we've never even heard of that were entered into the shot records of individual soldiers and Marines that went over there. So we know that experimental vaccines that were used, no matter how much they try and deny it.
Well, of course, I think that listeners have to understand that the shot records for almost all of the men we sent to the Gulf mysteriously disappeared. Now, having been in the military, I will tell you that's the one thing that followed you wherever you went was your shot record. But these all disappeared because they cannot let the American people understand that they experimented with our boys on massive scale. And, of course, that's totally uncalled for, without their knowledge or their consent. And these were not necessarily given for the benefit of the servicemen, but to find out what would happen. And of course, unfortunately, in the name of science, an awful lot of harm can be done. And this was what happened with the Tuskegee study. Those of you who have heard our interviews with Dr. Colin Ross, who's a psychiatrist, about some of the things that the mind experiments were done. His book, Bluebird, incidentally, is must reading because it's based on the CIA files that, of course, they did not want the American people to know what they were doing. Well, why don't you sort of pick up on this idea? Do we have any idea what these experimental vaccines were? I've heard that some people have said that these might have to do with the AIDS vaccines. Is there any truth to that, do you think?
Well, there was one vaccine that's kind of suspicious that we suspect may have been an experimental vaccine that the Army was working on with NIH, which was an AIDS vaccine. And actually, that was one of the vaccines that may have contained the mycoplasma fermentans. So that's one possibility. Not everybody received that vaccine. There's also the possibility that things like mycoplasma and other microorganisms contaminated some of the vaccines, and the anthrax vaccine is a number one issue for this. And in fact, I was just discussing this with one of my colleagues who will be unnamed because she's a physician in the VA system, and she really can't identify herself, or I can't identify her because it puts her at high risk.
Sure.
But she actually made sure that some of these vaccines were tested, because she did get samples of them and found things like mycoplasma contamination in the vaccines. And, of course, this is being hotly denied by the Department of Defense, but here you have somebody within the VA that is a distinguished researcher on her own right and head of Gulf War Research Center within the VA, and she's found in her own studies some of these contaminants in the actual vaccines, even though it was denied.
Well, of course, the thing is that the medical implications, the medical consequences, the disabilities they'd have to pay out, these men volunteered, and many of them were volunteered. They went off to fight for America. They come back, they're chronically ill, their lives are destroyed. And, of course, I think they're entitled to benefits. I think they're entitled to be taken care of. And I don't believe in a lot of government programs, but I believe we should take care of our servicemen. And they're lying to cover up their liability. Let's go to Gloria calling from Spokane. Apparently she has a fibromyalgia, and she has a question for you. Hi, Gloria. How are you doing?
Yes, Dr. Nicholson, I have a question for you. I'm a retired dental hygienist, not because I wanted to retire, but because of a disability. And it started with a work injury, but it turned into fibromyalgia and chronic fatigue. It just started with a localized neck injury, and there are many hygienists. There's a hygienist pain network. There are many hygienists who have fibromyalgia and chronic fatigue, and I'm just wondering if you have any ideas about what could precipitate this.
Well, one of the things that we've been looking into, particularly in the dental profession, and I've actually been asked to talk about this at the American Academy of Biological Dentistry, and they're a group of oral surgeons and dentists that are interested in things like chronic infections and their role in oral disease. And so I've gotten a little bit involved in this, and yes, we found that things like dentists and as you've been mentioning, your own profession, where people get chronically ill, often infections underlie this. And one of the reasons you're at risk is that you're playing around in a location where some of these chronic infections actually hide. And so it's very common in the oral cavity to see these types of infectious agents. And if you don't take the proper ways of protecting yourself, you can inadvertently expose yourself to some of these infections. And even though these things are not wildly contagious, they do pass. And we have one family study actually on our website that shows that veterans that came back from the Gulf War slowly passed their illnesses to spouses and then to children. And basically the spouses, when they got sick, came down with a diagnosis of chronic fatigue syndrome. And then when the children got sick, instead of being diagnosed with chronic fatigue syndrome, the most common diagnosis was autism or attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, ADHD, which is kind of interesting how different age groups show different signs and symptoms in the face of an infection. And we found that in these families that, yes, the chronic infection was there, the veteran had it, passed it to the spouse and to the children. And they all tested positive, not everyone in the family, which is kind of interesting. So the members of the family provides the control that we're looking for in this particular study. And if we look at those, we find that those are not infected. If they're well, if they are symptomatic, they turned out to be infected. And we have a number of different families. In fact, the publication, which is actually coming out shortly in the Journal of Chronic Fatigue Syndrome, is actually on our website. So I invite the public to take a look at this publication, because I think it's potentially important. It's the first time that it's actually, I think, been well demonstrated that these types of chronic infections can pass to family members and cause chronic illnesses. And I think there's an occupational risk. And if you look at chronic fatigue syndrome, for example, the health profession is at a very high risk to get these particular types of diseases. And I think there's a reason for that, and the reason is exposure.
And don't you think that perhaps it's even more common in dentists and in the dental hygienists than in the general population?
It is. It is. And we don't. I don't think there are really any good epidemiological studies on this. We've just noticed that just from the people contacting us and where they're from. Now, part of that you have to understand could be because dental hygienists and dentists and so on are better informed than the general public. But I don't think that's the real reason why they have such a high frequency of these problems.
Let me just get our telephone number out. I know somebody was calling in and we missed them. Our telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 888-264-8295. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. And I apologize for whoever called in earlier. But right now, Gloria, I really believe you have a problem. Have you checked Dr. Nicholson's
website? Actually, I did. I took some information off of Dr. Garth Nicholson's website and took it into my doctor. And before he looked at it, he kind of just poo-pooed everything. And then he actually called me up at home, you know, from his office to apologize. He was very impressed with your information. And he said, well, now if you come in and we put you on some long-term antibiotic therapy, we do have to discuss the risk of long-term therapy. But he was really impressed with your website and with all the information that I brought in. But I didn't know exactly how to coordinate it. I mean, what do you recommend? To get the blood test done, do you have to go to California, or do you have it done in the doctor's office? What do you recommend, doctor?
Well, the blood can be shipped to a laboratory either on the East Coast or the West Coast that does these types of tests, and that information is actually on the website as well for people without going into it in any detail. In some cases, the physicians have just decided to go ahead and treat just on the off chance that it might work. And we've seen a lot of success in doing that as well.
Mm-hmm. Okay, anything else?
Is there any relationship between the hepatitis B vaccination and a possibility of some of these chronic illnesses? Because, of course, many hygienists have also had the hepatitis B, and I was included in that.
Well, healthcare workers in general get a lot of hep B inoculations.
Right.
And yes, there is some relationship, and we're not exactly sure what it means, whether it means that, there's a slight immunosuppression and leaves you more open to opportunistic infections, or whether some of the hep B vaccines themselves may be contaminated, or a number of different issues that may be involved there. Vaccines are a very tricky business to discuss, you know, what they're actually doing and what they might cause in terms of illness and so on, and so we don't want to get involved too heavily in that. But one of the things that we're ranting and raving about is the fact that so many people, particularly young children, receive all these multiple vaccinations all at once. And the same thing happened during Desert Storm when the forces were deployed to the Persian Gulf.
Oh yeah,
they were given multiple vaccines, 20 to 30 within 2 or 3 day period. And this is very immune suppressing, by the way, when this happens. And even if there's a minor contaminant in one of the vaccines, all of a sudden this could be a major problem, where that one vaccine by itself may not be if your immune system is competent. Mm-hmm. But vaccines in general, if they're used poorly in really not an appropriate protocol, can be very immune suppressing. So that's another thing that we have to consider. I think vaccines in general, I'm not ranting and raving against vaccines in general, just in the way they're being used.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, Gloria.
Okay, well, thank you so much.
Why don't you follow through and let us know what happens, will you?
Okay, I will. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Bye-bye.
And let's go to Theodora calling from Santa Cruz. Hi, Theodora. How are you?
Hi, Dr. Stan. And I'm always glad to be listening when Dr. Nicholson's on. And my question is about the smallpox vaccine, because I'm very alarmed at the prospect of being forced to take this vaccine. I suspect it is contaminated. But the other aspect of it is to mention that the emergency health, I forget the total name of
you
that.
You mean the MEPA, Model Emergency Health Powers Act.
It apparently is back on the table in California, so people should be alerted to that. But I'd love to hear whether Dr. Nicholson has any inside information on
the smallpox
vaccine. Yeah.
All right, what are your thoughts on the smallpox vaccine, Dr. Nicholson?
Well, again, I think this goes to any vaccine. You just have to be very aware of the benefits versus the risk. And I think unless somebody is a first responder, you have to be very, very careful of being required to take these vaccines. Now, a first responder would be somebody in emergency personnel that would respond on the scene, let's say during an epidemic or during a bioterrorism attack or something like this. So they're going to be required to have all these different vaccinations. And the general public is not necessarily going to be required to do this unless they're a healthcare professional or something that might be in some way exposed. So you just have to be very careful about weighing the risks. And any time that you receive a vaccine, be sure and ask for the insert in the vaccine container. Every vaccine container by FDA regulation should have an insert, and the insert should give the information on the risks associated with that vaccine. So be sure and look at that before you take any vaccination.
Theodora, I think there are several considerations, both pro and con. Number one is, with all of the propaganda they put out, to date there are only about a couple of hundred at the most healthcare workers who've taken this voluntarily. Now, they've forcibly given it to the military, but very, very few to the general population. Of course, the healthcare workers union is saying, look, we want, of course, a guaranteed compensation. If somebody takes this and they come down ill, they ought to be compensated. Or if they are working in the hospital and they give it to one of the patients there, because you're giving them a live infection, you're giving them a vaccinia infection that can spread to others, especially if they have an altered immune system. And at least to date, the government hasn't wanted to either compensate the people who came down ill with this, who were seriously incapacitated by the vaccine, or gave it to others. And you wonder why. You know, if there's nothing to worry about, why they don't want to, for that very, very rare individual, compensate them. But the third, and I think the most significant thing, is that within the last week, the government has appropriated $20 million to find a safer smallpox vaccine. Now, if this is totally safe, why are they going to spend $20 million to find a safer vaccine?
Well, they may be spending $20 million to find a way to contaminate that vaccine, too. I just don't trust them.
Well,
is there any mechanism for actually, you mentioned this gal in the VA who was able to get hold of some of the stocks and run tests on them to find out if they were contaminated, and they were. Is there any movement or any way to get hold of these stocks and whichever, you know, whatever thing they're running at us that we can know ahead of time?
Well, that's a problem. You know, it's very difficult to get various lots. These vaccines are done in batches, and they all have lot numbers. And, you know, it's very difficult to get any particular lot in advance of you being vaccinated or a group of individuals being vaccinated. And that's a problem. And, you know, part of the problem really goes back to the vaccine industry. And I don't want to knock the industry, except that they, in a way, are a group of people who put their head in the sands very quickly. I was talking on a plane when I was going back east once with an executive from one of the companies that makes vaccines, I won't go into the name of the company, but very prominent company in the vaccine area. And I was talking to him about the possibility of contamination of the vaccines and so on, and the fact they really should be testing, for example, for a lot of these chronic infections. And they said, no, we can't do that. I mean, if we did that, we wouldn't make any money on these vaccines. I said, what do you mean make any money on the vaccines? I mean, you're potentially damaging people from the vaccines. Wouldn't you want to know about that? And they really don't want to know about it. And that's a very sad thing.
That's because Congress gave them protection. And, you know, whenever Congress passes a law, there are unintended consequences. And sometimes you get a far worse complications whenever they pass laws. If the vaccine companies could be held liable for the harm they could do, then, of course, they would be very, very careful. As long as they have immunity from prosecution, why should they be careful? But the major thing is, Theodora, wait until the smallpox. If suddenly there is an outbreak and a major smallpox epidemic, then there might very well be some time to reconsider whether or not the risk is worth the benefits. So we'll talk about that later, okay?
Well, I hope you do a program on the model.
We're going to have a doctor on next week on smallpox.
What day?
It's next Thursday, a week
from
now.
I'll write that down.
All right, fine.
Thank you, Dr. Stan.
Thank you so much. Bye-bye. Well, we're, of course, getting to the end of the program. We're going to have to bid goodbye to our listeners up in the Great Northwest. And again, of course, we ask you to seriously consider joining the Radio Liberty family of supporters so we can continue doing what we're doing and expand our coverage out across America. It's 5 hours every day. We talk to people and try to give them the cutting-edge technology and cutting-edge knowledge that will help them to prepare for what's going on. And in this instance, here we're giving you real solutions to the problems, or at least places you can go and get information that even your doctor doesn't know. And I'm not docking doctors. I love doctors. Most of them are wonderful people. And every week I go to a couple of medical meetings, and they're there. They're really trying to help, but they're not going to get this information from most medical journals. And, you know, unless they're reading these very specific medical journals, they're not going to know. So you're going to have to get the information and help them get that. And so the other thing is, of course, this is the time when we ask you to pray for our boys going into battle. and to pray for their families, pray for the people over there, the civilians, that many of them may be damaged in the coming battle. And, of course, we ask you to pray for our leaders and for our ministers. Pray for revival in America, because if the people of this country don't turn back to God, I seriously fear that God will turn his back on this country. And lastly, we ask you to remember my ministry, Radio Liberty. Pray for our provision and protection, especially as we continue trying to bring you the truth on the front lines, where truth sometimes is not very much appreciated. So we'll bid good night to our listeners up in the great state of Washington, and we'll be back in just a few moments here at Radio Liberty to continue this next hour at Radio Liberty and, of course, www.radioliberty.com. This is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story. Hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that's going to determine what the future will bring. And I have to remind you, the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of this station. They're my views, the views of our guests, the views of our callers, and of course we welcome your calls from out across America at 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. But we ask you to hold your calls. We have with us this evening Dr. Garth Nicholson from the Institute of Molecular Medicine in Southern California, and certainly on the front lines of the research on many of these chronic infections that plague so many Americans today. And it's as you begin talking about this, you begin to find out that there are so many people that actually have these chronic infections, and they really need help. And right now, we're going to be have Randy on the line, and I'm not sure. This has to do with program tomorrow. I tell our producer Randy not to worry about that. We'll get to him later. There was a message from my producer on the screen. I'm trying to talk and of course do this. Well, Dr. Nicholson, is there a growing awareness, you think, across America, that there is a problem? Is this getting to the general medical profession? Because as Gloria was telling, her doctor was very, very skeptical. And I hear this time and time and time again from our listeners, that, you know, when they first go to their doctors and tell them about this, and, you know, they sort of smirk a little and say, oh, sure, you know. And then, of course, if they can really get them to read your material, maybe want to look into it. But a lot of doctors are just so busy, they don't have time to read about it. And, you know, there's something, if I don't know about it, it can't be true. And I'll have to admit, sometimes when I was practicing medicine, I'm going to meetings all the time, and I'm reading journals, and, well, if something I don't know, it can't really be a thing. And my patients would come in with these articles about the newspaper or someplace they'd heard about it, and there's always a tendency to sort of discount what on what your patients say. And yet, of course, as the older I got, sometimes I begin to realize that sometimes the patients really might have interesting information we better start looking into. But what's your success been in getting the true story about the Gulf War illness and the association, certainly with not only the mycoplasma infection, because that's only about 40%, but then, of course, many of these other people have exposure to various chemicals and toxins while they were in the Gulf?
Well, you know, again, these problems are very complex, and having taught medical school for over 25 years, both in California at the University of California system and in Texas at the University of Texas system, I can tell you that physicians in general are not prepared for any new thoughts. And one of the problems, of course, is the time element. Most of them feel, particularly now in the time of managed care, that they really don't have time to keep up with the newest and latest developments, unless they are able to go to a meeting, and then they usually go to specialty meetings in their area, their specialization, and so on. And they don't really get this key general information from those types of meetings. And although I'm being invited to more and more specialty meetings outside really any area that I've actually been acquainted with or taught in, so I think slowly but surely the information is creeping in. But a lot of people just have never seen it, either in the general public or in the medical profession.
And I think it's just so vitally important that we get the information out. And one reason, of course, I talk to you here in the listening audience is so that you can, even if you don't have chronic fatigue syndrome or don't know anybody who has it, become acquainted with this. And you may run into somebody, and I'll tell you what, the people with chronic fatigue are some of the most miserable people that I know. They really are. I mean, it's an awful disease.
Well, it's not just something like chronic fatigue syndrome or fibromyalgia syndrome, but there's a whole class of other illnesses out there, rheumatic illnesses in general. A lot of those people have these types of infections. For example, heart disease. Many people with heart conditions don't know it, but have these infections. My own father actually fits in this category. He had a major problem with his heart, and it turns out that he had one of these infections, in this case, chlamydia pneumoniae, and also he had mycoplasma pneumoniae, two very unusual chronic infections that can destroy your heart and also the vascular system. And these types of infections invade the blood vessels, and they cause inflammation, and they cause clotting problems, and eventually this could lead to a stroke or lead to heart disease or things like this. So there are a number of ways in which these chronic infections can really affect your body, and it really depends a lot on your genetic makeup and your immunology and a number of other factors that determines what kind of illness you might come down with.
Well, I think one of the things I was most interested in when I was studying this chronic fatigue syndrome was the fact that so many of the people with this condition have problem thinking, they have problem concentrating, they have problem getting anything accomplished. Even some of the most minor tasks are just, from a mental point of view, are just so trying. Have you run into this?
Oh, it's very common, and of course it goes along with the young man who called earlier that had Gulf War illness, and these lesions were showing up on his brain. And again, this can happen with people with chronic illnesses that have these infections that can invade into the central nervous system, because they do cause a number of changes in the central nervous system, and these can affect your memory process, cognitive process, so on. They are, I think, very, very important in determining our ability to think, our ability to memorize, our ability to recall, and a number of other problems as well. So all of these things could be affected if you have these infections. So that's one of the reasons why we've been investing so much time in looking at the role of these types of infections in neurodegenerative diseases.
Are you acquainted with Hillary Johnson's book, Oster's Web?
Yes, I've read it, but it's been a long time since I've read it.
So. Well, I'm just going to mention for our listeners, we did get a supply of these in. It's a hard book to get. In fact, I didn't even know they were available, and somebody was able to get some for us. And so these are in paperback. They're not that expensive. You know anybody who has a chronic fatigue syndrome, and you'd like to get hold of a wonderful mystery story, but it's not a mystery. I mean, it's not a novel. It's all factual, and it's the effort to try to track down the cause of chronic fatigue syndrome. Fascinating book, very important book, and if you know anybody who has chronic fatigue syndrome, I think, vital, really, so they have some grasp of what this is about, and they're not alone, and of course, Osler's Web by Hillary Johnson, one of the most fascinating reads you'll ever have. Reads like a mystery. The trouble is, it's the real story of what's going on today, and it's so vitally important that people understand that this is a real clinical entity. It's not something that's made up. It's not psychological. These people are suffering, and of course, fortunately, we have people like Dr. Garth Nicholson and a few others that are really on the front lines of this battle, trying to get the information out and offer the people help.
You know, one of the problems, and going back again, the fact that I've taught for so long in medical school, I'm sure you have too, is that when you see how different paradigms are presented in medicine, in the old days we used to look at things like infection, is that one infection causes one diseases. If you have influenza, you get flu. If you have a polio virus infection, you get polio. But it's a lot more complex than that. It's a lot more complicated. And as we start looking at some of the modern diseases, like we've been discussing now, we find that they're not just generally one infection or one cause. There are a number of different causes, and that's what makes these illnesses so complex. And we were just starting to touch on some of the other aspects. In addition to chronic illnesses, there are a number of other toxic insults that may be important. For example, chemical exposure, heavy metal exposure, so on and so forth. We find a lot of these patients have multiple problems, not just infections, but they have other problems as well. They have problems in their diet, they have problems in metal contamination, they have problems in chemical contamination, so on and so forth. And it all tends to add up. All these toxic insults on your body tend to add up. And it's very difficult to sort through these. You almost have to go to an environmental physician who understands the role of these multiple toxic exposures and causing illness before you can really get a handle on what's going on.
Well, let's go to Lee, who's calling in here from Watsonville. Hi, Lee. How are you doing?
Pretty well, thanks.
Okay,
I have
fine.
A couple questions. The first is, what do you recommend to treat chronic fatigue with an active herpes 6 virus?
Well, let me take that one first, because there's some people that have suggested certain use of some antivirals and so on to treat HHV6. And HHV6 is a very common virus in chronic fatigue syndrome patients. In fact, we have a paper on our website showing that it's a common co-infection with mycoplasma. So these are things which, these chronic viruses and bacteria that get together that cause illness, and maybe not on their own, but by the time they get together with a number of other factors, you have illness or morbidity. We suggest first that people try immune enhancement more than anything, and we found that this has been pretty effective if it's done properly, and that means that people have to try a number of different things to see what really works with their system. But that's been the easiest way to attack that problem. The next step is to go to some type of antiviral. That gets a little more iffy, and of course, with any of the antivirals and the side effects, sometimes are worse than the disease itself. So you have to be a bit careful. So we suggest immune enhancement to begin with.
Okay.
Have you gone to Dr. Nicholson's website?
Yes.
Okay, fine. So you're acquainted with the material that he has there.
Yeah, I need to read it some more.
Okay, fine.
My other question was whether he thinks that transfer factor is safe and or effective.
Well, again, there are many different types of transfer factors, and these are things which have to be tried because, in principle, they should be effective. The problem is, in practice, there's so few of the transfer factor preparations that are made against the appropriate materials, that are targeting the appropriate materials, and that are really useful for an individual. There are some products that are being made. I'm not going to really mention any brand names, but transfer factor is one of the products that we recommend. There are a couple of different general transfer factors that have proven to be quite useful for patients, for example, that have chronic fatigue syndrome. And you just have to look at our website. There are two or three commercial formulations that are suggested there that patients try. And again, you just have to try them.
Okay.
But it is one of the products that we are recommending.
For an orthopedic surgeon, would you mind explaining what a transfer factor is? Is that one of the immune enhancers?
It's an immune enhancer, but it's kind of a natural immune enhancer. It's a low molecular weight form that will boost the immune system. Without getting into detail, you can generate these types of transfer factors, for example, in herds of cows or other types of animals. And so you can actually generate these specific responses if animals are immunized with, for example, a pathogen. And there's some general immune enhancement or general transfer factor preparations that are obtained from specific herds or whatever. So these are things that can be isolated from colostrum, for example, or other fractions of milk and milk products and so on that are naturally used to boost immunity in the young offspring. But we, of course, will isolate them and use them to try and boost our own immunity.
Okay, fine. Anything else, Lee?
No, that's it. Thanks very much.
You're more than welcome.
Bye-bye.
Well, you know, Krista, this is really such a wide field, and it really gets down to the very basis of immunology and our immune response. Now, of course, when I was going through school, we'd never heard of herpes 6, and it's only in recent years, and I suppose maybe the last 20 years or so, that this has become commonly spoken of. I know that when, of course, they were talking about AIDS, and they were talking about cofactors with HIV infection, creating this clinical picture we call AIDS, that Robert Gallo had said that he thought that herpes 6 was the cofactor. And, of course, it was Luc Montagnier, the French scientist who originally located or identified the HIV virus, who said that it was a mycoplasma, that he recognized a mycoplasma cofactor. First of all, is herpes 6 something relatively new, or has it been around for a long time? And is there one or a number of cofactors in this clinical syndrome we call AIDS?
Well, I think there may be a number of cofactors in AIDS, and we just don't really know enough about it to know which of these are really important as cofactors or not just going along with the disease because of the immune suppression. But I think HHV6 and mycoplasma are two of the most important, and there may be others as well. But those two, for sure, we have a pretty good inkling that they're very, very important in the disease process or the pathogenicity.
All right, fine. Well, of course, is this mycoplasma infection, at least widespread, something really rather recent in time, something we did not see, say, 50 years ago, and the same thing with herpes 6?
Well, I think they were there 50 years ago, but whether they were there in the same combination or the same pathogenicity, that we really don't know. And this is one of the interesting aspects of the evolution of disease. As we go along, do you tend to select for more pathogenic forms or select for more benign forms? And it could go either way, and we're just really not sure. Some of these things have been experimented with in the laboratory, and who knows, more pathogenic species may have evolved. We had some evidence from the Gulf War that there was a more pathogenic form of Mycoplasma fermentans. We found some unusual genetic signatures in the bug that we got from veterans, and that suggested that it may have been manipulated. So some of this may be going on to develop incapacitating agents, for example, war agents and so on. We just don't really know enough about it to come out conclusively and say that this is what's happening. But I have my suspicions.
Well, now, of course, there was an outbreak of mycoplasma infection in Huntsville in Texas, where they had a state prison, or at least a prison there. And, of course, something was given, my understanding is there were records, that there had been experiments on the prisoners, and the disease got from the prisoners to the guards, from the guards to their families. And there was just a terrible amount of disease, and multiple sclerosis or
anti-. Well, I know this story quite well, because it's one of the reasons I left Texas, because after the Gulf War, many guards and their family members were coming to us because we were getting some publicity on our work with Gulf War veterans, and they said, well, look, we've got the same problem, only we've had it since the mid-1980s. And what it correlated to was actually studies in the prison system on mycoplasma vaccines and so on. Of course, it was totally denied by the Texas Department of Corrections, but then some... I call them the three moms. They were three mothers who happened to be involved with the prison system in one way or another because of spouses or family members that worked in the prison system. And they actually dug out the information showing that they were lying, that they were conducting experiments without informed consent in the prison system, and that mycoplasmas were one of the things that they were experimenting on. And it's very interesting because if you look at a little town like Huntsville, Texas, where there are three prisons, which totally dominates the employment in that area, a lot of people worked in the prisons. They were coming home and getting sick and passing their illness to family members. There were 40 cases of ALS in Huntsville alone, in this period of time. And that's a little town of about 30,000, 35,000. And remember, this is something in general population that is in an incidence level of 1 in 100,000. So how come there are 40 cases in this one little town? Well, it all correlated, and all of these people were related to the prison system and the prisons where these experiments were going on. Guards were getting sick, and some of them dying, and their family members were getting sick, and so on. It was a real mess there, and it caused quite a furor when we started testing some of the guards and their family members and finding these unusual infections in them, just like we found in the Gulf War veterans. And so we had a suspicion that some of this went on before the Gulf War. They tested it first on prisoners and then eventually on soldiers.
And, of course, the tragic events, of course, are all across America today. And, of course, I suspect that it's in the general population as well. And, of course, this is going to impact potentially on everybody out there in the listening audience. And when you have these macabre experiments being taking place here in this country, and, of course, they're lying to us. And when the prison there, the prison system in Huntsville, actually lied. And these, I've actually interviewed one of the ladies there. And they actually had somebody go in into the files, and they actually got the contracts that had been given to the prison. And they lied, and actually they had the contracts and said, look, you use this, you know, you use this on the prisoners, and now it's in the general population. Were they ever able to get any compensation for the people who were incapacitated because of these experiments?
Not to my knowledge. I haven't really kept up on it a lot. They try and drag me back into that controversy. I try to avoid it. It's one of the reasons I left the state, actually, because I did not want to get tied up in that. It's a very ugly type of thing that's going on down there now, and they still haven't actually ferreted out all of the information from the prison system on exactly what happened.
But, of course, they can't really come out in public and admit this sort of thing, because they might actually be accused of using biological warfare, or actually developing new biological warfare agents in violation of the treaties that we had signed.
Well, there are a number of violations, of course, that went on down there, but the one that's most glaring is the fact that they didn't use appropriate informed consent in these experiments. This is almost like the Tsugi experiments that we hear about on the syphilis, of course, many years ago in Alabama in the prison system and so on. This is just as bad, and they were losing several prisoners a week in this one prison, for example, in Huntsville. And I know this story very well because one of the pathologists that I trained went to Galveston and became an associate professor down there after his training with me. And he became deputy head of the autopsy division at the University of Texas Medical Branch in Galveston. And by law in the state of Texas, every prisoner that dies has to go to that unit and be autopsied. And they weren't getting the prisoners. They were going to an Army base outside of San Antonio for autopsy. And then they were being privately cremated in a special crematorium that they built just for that purpose. So, it became so disgusting that, this was shades of what happened during World War II almost. So it just is a very ugly situation that I don't want to revisit.
Well, I don't blame you at all. I mean, you're doing such a good job in getting the information out on the Gulf War syndrome, and I'm sure the people down there in Huntsville are still working as best they can to try to get the truth out on that. But I do believe that people have to understand that some of the macabre experiments, for our listeners out there, if you have not heard about Operation Bluebird, and, of course, the effort to create mental illness in people under CIA contracts. Psychiatrists actually did this, and they even wrote it up in the peer review articles in their journals. And, of course, it's all covered in Operation Bluebird, written by a psychiatrist who got hold of 15,000 pages of CIA documents and read them all. And those that weren't redacted tell an amazing and, indeed, a frightening story. And remember, it did not stop with the Nuremberg trials, and it certainly didn't stop when they stopped the Tuskegee study here in the United States, that study that was aimed at taking 400 black men and with intentionally withholding treatment for their syphilis. Unfortunately, this sort of thing still goes on without consent or knowledge of many of the people who are being experimented on. Let's get back, of course, to Dr. Garth Nicholson and the information that we have. Now, as far as the MS, what about, you mentioned, of course, that ALS seemed to respond to these treatments. What about multiple sclerosis? Would that respond to any of these immune enhancers?
Well, again, if someone is infected with some of these unusual infections, yes, and it kind of flies against the face of common knowledge in a way. I mean, you think if somebody has an autoimmune disease, you know, you wouldn't want to stimulate their immune system, but you have to understand that the immune system is very particular in what it responds to and responds against. And so it actually, if you have something that's triggering an autoimmune response, when you boost the immune system, you actually fight to prevent that from happening. You don't make it worse. So you have to be very careful in the case of MS to make sure you know exactly, you know, or have a better picture at least of what's going on with the disease process before you use immune enhancers. But if you find that there is a chronic infection that may be stimulating the autoimmunity, then for sure boosting the immune system should help. And in fact, we've seen that in patients.
Well, now, didn't you? You told me one time that you'd actually tested a fair number of MS patients, and what about 40% of them were infected? What percentage would have?
About half of them were infected, for example, with mycoplasma that we tested. So it is an important subset of those patients. It doesn't account for everything, but we think that there again is an important subset that we can identify that have chronic infections, and those are the patients that benefit very dramatically from suppression of their infections.
Well, do you think that perhaps MS has multiple causes, just like the other things we've talked about? There's not just one cause for it, but you have a symptom complex with multiple causes.
Well, that's what I was kind of stressing before. There are a number of toxic insults to our system that may evolve into an autoimmune illness, or in other cases that may revolve into a rheumatic illness, or in other cases into a fatiguing illness, and so on. And unfortunately, we don't understand the combination and how it may interact in one individual to cause a specific disease. But we do know that these things are there, and we do know they play a role. And we do know if you treat them that you do better. Either you eliminate the disease or you certainly recover to various degrees. And I think that's the important thing. And obviously, we're talking about things which will ultimately lead to treatments and ultimately lead to, you know, something that's of benefit. Not just something that we're interested in for esoteric reasons.
Well, now, haven't a lot of the people on with chronic fatigue syndrome or Gulf War illness had really dramatic improvement on treatment for, 6 months or a year?
Yes, and we've seen that, and other people have seen that as well now, and I think it's becoming more and more accepted as more and more people recover from these conditions. And you have to understand that in the case of, for example, chronic fatigue syndrome, a lot of people just never recover from that condition. They simply stay the same or get worse with time. And as they age, of course, in general, they get worse. And so this is something that in the past there haven't been too many successes. But we've seen a lot of success in the people that have been treated with our regimens. And it's not everyone. But again, if you can identify a chronic infection, then you at least you know how to proceed from there.
Well, our telephone number is, of course, 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. This is 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. Our guest is Dr. Garth Nicholson from the Institute of Molecular Medicine in Southern California. And we're talking about this group of diseases that are related to chronic infections and, of course, mycoplasma, herpes 6, and then, of course, the chlamydia. We haven't touched too much on chlamydia, but chlamydia, of course, is a disease that many times it goes right along with this symptom complex. And, of course, the significant thing about the chlamydia is that sometimes this will get into the body, and it will actually cause intra-arterial blockage. It will actually cause heart attack and strokes themselves, won't they?
Yes, in fact, both chlamydia and certain mycoplasmas are very important risk factors for heart disease and coronary problems. And one of the things that we find with these types of intracellular bacteria, and chlamydia and mycoplasma fall in that category of bacteria that get inside the cells themselves and cause problems, one of their first target on entering the body, besides the epithelial lining of the gut, the nasal passages, and so on, is the circulatory system. They get in the endothelial cells that line our circulation system, and they cause inflammation in that area. And one of the things that inflammation will cause will be a hypercoagulation response. So a lot of these patients, they have hypercoagulation problems. And, of course, when you have that, then you're at higher risk for stroke and cardiovascular disease. And along with that inflammation, of course, then you can build up plaque in your vascular system, and this can result, of course, in a closing off of the arteries and so on. If it happens in your heart, this can be a major problem. And one of the other things that happens with these types of infections and the inflammation they cause is a generalized inflammation, and sometimes this will lead to conditions like endocarditis of the heart and so on. And we're seeing more and more of this, I think, or at least more and more is being diagnosed because we have better methods of diagnosing it now than ever before. So along with the circulatory changes and the problems with the heart, these are major areas of importance, I think, in medical care these days.
Well, now, is some of this actually reversible with antibiotic treatment?
Yes, we think it is, and that's what's been found, actually. And again, it takes long-term therapy because these slow-growing intracellular microbes like chlamydia and mycoplasma, they're difficult to suppress with antibiotics. They're not like the traditional rapidly growing bacteria that are very rapidly suppressed by antibiotics. These things are smoldering infections, and they take a long time to really suppress. So in general, we recommend long-term antibiotic therapy if one has a positive test for one of these microbes. But along with that, there are a number of other supplements and immune enhancement and antioxidants and lipid replacement therapy and a number of other things that are required.
Well, you know, of course, when I practiced medicine, we were, of course, always very aware that duodenal ulcers, gastric ulcers, they were all related, of course, to stress. And if we just could relieve people of their stress or put them on a diet, why, we could cure them. And then some crazy guy came out and said, don't you know that these are infections? Most of them are related to this organism that lives there and creates the ulcers. And that just revolutionized the treatment of ulcers. And, of course, there's so many things we're finding out. Now, we're going to be back in just a moment or two. But now, of course, we don't treat ulcers with them the same way we used to at all. Many times they're just treated with antibiotics. Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, and this is the time when we have to remind our listeners here in the Monterey Bay Area and out across America that Radio Liberty is listener-supported. We're really dependent upon those of you who believe that there's a problem and believe we're not necessarily getting all of the information through regular channels. And, of course, we might be considered the alternative radio, but I would feel that we are the ones who are trying to bring you what we believe is the truth, and we try to get the fascinating guests such as we have this evening to give you certainly the cutting edge of what's going on in medicine and this new thought about so many of the chronic diseases we have and the increasing number of chronic disabling diseases that are infecting not only the military population but the general population as well. So if you're out there and you believe that we have an important message and you'd like to become part of the Radio Liberty family of supporters, our telephone number is 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-5-HIV-WAR. If you'd like to get a copy of our latest newsletter, why, you can call us at that number, 1-800-544-8927, 1-800-5-HIV-WAR. We'll be glad to send you a copy of our newsletter, and you can get that on a regular basis if you'd like to. And just talk to the people there. Of course, we'll suggest you go to our website, which is www.radioliberty.com. That's radioliberty.com. And, of course, you'll get all of our newsletters going back a number of years, and you're welcome to copy them and to distribute them. You'll find fascinating information there that you're not going to get elsewhere. You'll find out what the Iraqi people really believe about Saddam Hussein. Well, I guess that's the March newsletter. That's not up on the screen just yet, but it will be here in another week or so. And, of course, what do the Iraqi people really believe about Saddam Hussein? You'll be surprised that most Iraqis that had talked to a CIA agent over there wrote a book called See No Evil. The man's name was Robert Baer. Most of them believe the USA has been keeping Saddam Hussein in power. How could that be? After all, isn't he this wicked Saddam Hussein with the weapons of mass destruction that threaten not only the neighbors over there, but threaten the United States itself? Well, you have to understand why the Iraqis think that we kept Saddam Hussein in power, at least according to Robert Baer, a longtime CIA operative. Some of them even think that Saddam is on the CIA payroll now. I'm not suggesting that's true at all. I'm just saying it just doesn't make sense that faced with the possibility of certainly being captured or being killed in the coming war, that he's refusing to leave. If I were he, I would certainly pick up and leave, unless, of course, he knows something that the rest of us don't know. It's going to be very interesting to see what happens in the next 48 hours. Logic would tell you he would leave and take his ill-gotten gains and ask for a guarantee of asylum someplace, but that apparently is not going to be the case. So let's see how this thing plays out. But if you read our newsletters, you'll get information from many sources that is not generally available on the regular medium. The book, of course, we refer to is called See No Evil, and if you want to find out more about that book, See No Evil by Robert Baer, actually gone over by the CIA before it was published, because you'll see the what parts that have been censored out. Give us a call at 1-800-544-8927. Consider joining the Radio Liberty family. Tell others about our website at radioliberty.com. Tell them about our ministry. And, of course, we hope, of course, you'll become a regular listener, and you'll encourage others to become regular listeners to Radio Liberty. Well, this evening our special guest is Dr. Garth Nicholson from the Institute of Molecular Medicine in Southern California. And Dr. Nicholson has taught in medical schools here in California. He's taught in medical schools in Texas. And, of course, now he's involved in research. And, of course, he's had an opportunity to travel throughout the world talking to people in various areas about the Gulf War illness. And certainly he is, in my estimation, the world's leading expert on that. What about in other countries? Certainly we know, of course, the Gulf War illness had a devastating impact on the United States. But what about the people from Great Britain and the other nations that had their troops in the Gulf back in 1990 and 1991?
Well, they have similar problems to us, particularly in the UK and Canada and Australia and the other Gulf War coalition partners that received the multiple vaccines during deployment. They certainly have a problem. And the one glaring exception really are the French. The French forces did not use multiple vaccines to protect against biological weapons. They actually used prophylactic antibiotics instead. And they don't have the problem with Gulf War illness like we have. They had very few of their forces that actually came down with Gulf War illness. And so we think that their strategy for countering Saddam Hussein's biological weapons was really a better strategy than our own. But somehow, since the Revolutionary War, the Army, the U.S. Army, has been tied up with the vaccines as protection against infection, and they really haven't considered other things. But I think that's going to change in the current conflict.
Well, I certainly hope so. Now, of course, you were a visiting professor over in Kuwait, weren't you, after the Gulf War?
Yes, I was.
Why don't you tell us a little bit about the health situation over there? Is there a lot of illness among the people living in Kuwait? And, of course, what about the people who get in the areas out in the desert where the depleted uranium dust is? First of all, what about in the cities of Kuwait? Do they have a significant incidence of Gulf War illness or Gulf War-like illness?
Well, they do, and now they're claimed, at least when I went to some of the clinics in the outlying areas outside of Kuwait City, that now 15% to 20% of the population is now have a variety of different chronic illnesses, such as chronic fatigue syndrome, for example, that they didn't have before the Gulf War. They were exposed to a lot of toxic materials, of course, during the Gulf War. And this may have a lot to do with their conditions. But we just don't know the extent of it. Part of the problem is officially this is not acknowledged by the central government. It's only when you get down to the level of going out again to these clinics that you find out about this. But it's there, and it wasn't there before the Gulf War. And we think that they have a variety of the same problems that we see in other countries.
No, but of course, this wouldn't be a mycoplasma. Would this be more the result of some sort of a chemical reaction or response to the toxic chemicals they came in contact with? Or is there any increased incidence of mycoplasma there in the population?
Well, there is. It's hard to know if it's an increase or not because we don't really have much information before the Gulf War, but there's certainly that there now, at least.
They actually have the mycoplasma infection?
Yeah, we've seen that there, but we're not quite sure what the actual incidence is, and we don't know anything about before the Gulf. They also experienced a number of other exposures during the war. There were chemical fires and petroleum fires going on for almost a year after the Gulf War, and so there was chronic exposure to petrochemical hydrocarbons. And of course, again, we don't know the extent of that, and we have a feeling that that's important in their health conditions as well. Heavy metals, there was some exposure to heavy metals, at least in northern Kuwait. There was depleted uranium where the armored units attacked north of Kuwait City on the way to Basra, and so there's some depleted uranium in the environment. A lot of that is now been buried in the sand. At least the Kuwaitis took all the Iraqi armor that was destroyed north of Kuwait City and buried it in these huge plots of burial grounds that have high fences around them now. So they knew that there was something wrong there, and they took action to try and put it as deep underground as possible.
Well, now, of course, we're told that there's absolutely no danger from depleted uranium, that, you know, after all, the government has studied this, and it's a very effective metal, it's very heavy, and, of course, it will pierce armor, it can, of course, protect our tanks so from incoming shells, and our shells can then go through other people's tanks, and of course you can handle these shells without any deleterious effects. And any talk about this being dangerous, depleted uranium, is simply hysteria having no basis in fact. Though we do know that certainly the Europeans for a time were very worried about that because of certainly a number of the people who served in Kosovo, where there'd been a tremendous amount of depleted uranium that produced the dust produced by the explosion of the bombs and shells. There was there seemed to be a fairly high incidence of leukemia, and then the report came out and said, oh no, although they have 8 cases of it, why, that's no higher than you'd expect among a similar number of cases. So what is the truth? Is there something to be concerned about or not, or do we know?
Well, if there is nothing to be concerned about, the 19 NATO forces that were involved, for example, in Bosnia, wouldn't be testing their deployed forces for depleted uranium contamination. So, yes, there is some risk involved in that, but the major risk is not in handling the uranium metal that's, of course, used as armor penetrators and also as armor in protective shields on military vehicles. The danger is when these penetrators hit the target at very high velocity, because they actually vaporize, they burn, and they turn into uranium oxide. And the problem there is the uranium oxide itself is a very kind of a small particle dust that settles down on the equipment that's damaged, on the sand and so on, and it can be kicked up by wind and actually inhaled. And when it gets in our lungs, that's the principal a way that it can really damage us, because then it can be absorbed and ultimately it ends up in our organs and bones in particular. So if there's heavy contamination, ultimately it will end up in the bones, and there, because some of it's radioactive, it can damage the bone marrow. So there are some real significant health problems with depleted uranium, but it depends on the form.
Well, no, of course, we're told, yes, it's radioactive, but there's hardly any significant radioactivity. After all, it's depleted uranium. But doesn't that have a half-life about, 4 billion years or something?
Well, it has the thousands of years half-life, but the main problem, again, is not the depleted uranium metal. It's the uranium oxide that's the problem. So, again, if it hits a hard target, it vaporizes. That's the real problem. It's not so much the heavy metal. It's very rare to find any problems with heavy metals. In a few cases, in friendly fire cases and during the Gulf War, where combat forces were hit with friendly fire and depleted uranium, and there were these fragments actually in the injured soldiers, they had a chance to study these, and even with those uranium pieces of uranium splinters in the soldiers, they really didn't come down with an illness that was similar to Gulf War illness. So we don't think it causes that. But again, it has its own problems because of the radioactivity and so on, and the fact that it's a heavy metal. If it's absorbed, this can cause problems like any heavy metal can cause in our bodies.
All right, fine. And what about these studies that were done in Europe as far as the leukemia and saying, well, look, the incidence of leukemia among the young men serving the Gulf, even though I think there were 8 cases, I remember. You probably remember that better than I do. That's no more than we would see in the general population. And that seemed like a rather high incidence for the general population.
Well, I think it was actually ended up to be higher than that in terms of the number, but yes, it was above the expected number, and that's why they've started conducting this study among the NATO countries to examine this a little more carefully. And again, we're not quite sure why, but battlefields are very toxic environments, and depleted uranium is one of the toxins, one of the most difficult toxins to deal with in the environment. But there are other there are other things as well. There are other heavy metals, for example. There are a variety of different chemicals and so on in that environment. So a battlefield is a pretty toxic place, and some of these toxins undoubtedly are mutagenic and cause changes in our DNA, and ultimately this can end up being cancer.
Well, Chris, now, can this actually influence our immune response and lay us open to these chronic infections? In other words, are these battlefield toxins? We're talking about the petrochemicals, the other things that we know that many of our young men were exposed to poison gas, to sarin gas, because when we blew up the depots there, I think there were 100 depots or something at a place called Kamachia, and of course they blow up these explosive shells that have chemicals and warfare agents in them. When they blow them up, amazingly enough, they exploded. And instead of course, burning them, they blew them up. And initially, they denied any of our boys had any chemical exposure. And then they admitted, well, maybe a few hundred, a few thousand, maybe 5,000, maybe 10,000, maybe 50,000. Last figure I saw, they finally admitted 130,000 American troops had been exposed to these sarin and other poison gases. Now, will these affect the immune system in some way?
Well, we just don't know. I think the evidence is rather sketchy on the role of, for example, chemical agents in causing immune disturbances, although the immune system is very tied up with the neurologic system, and so in that regard, there could be some effects there. In general, chemicals, toxic chemicals, can affect the immune system. And again, it wasn't just the matter of having chemical agents blown up at Kamachia. There were a number of other different damaging toxin materials in those bunkers as well, including biologic agents, including a lot of heavy metals and a lot of other types of chemicals as well in those bunkers when they blew them up. So these contaminated a pretty wide area, and we just don't know the effects yet. They're trying to unravel this now to see if people that were in the areas closest to the Kamachia bunkers versus those that were further away show a higher incidence of illness, and I don't know what the reports are on that.
Well, who's doing the study? Is the military doing the study, or is that being done from other concerned people?
Well, I think the military is conducting those studies, and possibly the VA, because many of these people have left the military now. We have a whole new generation in the Gulf. Most of these people that are over there deployed now were just too young to be there during the first Gulf War. That was about a decade ago. We have a whole new crop of people that are over in the Gulf right now, and they're interested to see if these people come down with the same illnesses. In fact, just before the program, I just finished an article which will come out actually in a military magazine, which is entitled "Return to the Gulf." And essentially, are we going to see the same types of illnesses in this next war that's coming up? That unfortunately, it doesn't seem like we can stop. Compared to the last war. And my conclusion is, yes, we're going to see casualties of very similar nature.
Well, I had heard, of course, today, this evening, that they were, of course, opening the valves and letting the oil from the oil wells there in Iraq flow out in the desert, I suppose, with the idea of setting that afire as our troops began moving through that region. And certainly that would be a terrible, terrible thing as far, just as far as the smoke from it was concerned.
Yes, it is, and of course those don't really present much of a barrier to a modern armored force that can use bulldozers, armored bulldozers, and tanks with bulldozer blades on the front and push right over those brims that have been built up and oil put behind them and ignited. So it's to see this kind of thing happening all over again. It's a terrible waste of the environment. We saw that in Kuwait, actually, when my wife and I were visiting in Kuwait, and I was a visiting professor there, they had dug these canals, doing exactly the same thing that they're doing now in Iraq itself. And they poured the petroleum into these dikes, more or less, and into these large areas and large pools, and then, of course, lit them on fire to form barriers, barriers, and they weren't very effective.
These were the Iraqis or the Kuwaitis?
Oh, these were the Iraqis.
Okay.
Iraqi army did this, and they weren't very effective as barriers, but they sure caused a lot of environmental contamination, and they're still trying to clean it up.
All right. In other words, basically, with the oil fires there, that would contaminate the things situation.
Well, it was not only the oil fires; it was not only the explosive charges on the oil well heads themselves, and creating these huge fires that we saw, of course, all over the press and so on. What I'm talking about are the actual canals or dikes that they made, and they poured in oil in these canals and dikes to form oil barriers, which they then ignited. These formed a terrible environmental destruction when all this oil is burning oil and so on, forms kind of a gooey residue, which is just awful to look at. It's just a terrible thing, and these big pools and birds and other wildlife get caught in them and so on and so forth. I mean, it's almost like the La Brea tar pits down in Los Angeles. As a boy, I can remember going down there and seeing the bubbling tar pits and so on, and how animals get caught in that, and eventually they're preserved, everything from saber-toothed tigers to mammoths and so on. But it's almost a modern-day version of the tar pits.
Well, of course, now you were commenting that what 15% to 20% of the Kuwaiti population is ill today with some sort of a chronic illness?
Well, chronic illnesses, they really don't know what they are and how to treat them any more than we do. And these were just the reports from physicians in these clinics themselves, because they hadn't seen any of these illnesses, or certainly not in the same frequency before the Gulf War compared to after the Gulf War. So there are illnesses in the population that they just didn't see before.
And the crises of the civilian population. What about the Kuwaiti army? Were they subject to any sort of illnesses?
Yes, I'm not sure the actual number of casualties in the Kuwaiti army. The Kuwaiti army, some of the Kuwaiti army, of course, was out of Kuwait and served with the coalition forces. Other members of the Kuwaiti army were prisoners of war during this process, and so. Again, they have to sort all that out to determine, exposures and who was where and what types of exposures they received and so on and so forth. And to my knowledge, at least when I was there a few years ago, they hadn't really sorted that out. But they did have illness. They were very interested in the work that we were doing and finding out some of the underlying causes of Gulf War illnesses in general. And so were some of the other coalition armies that we've been advising. The Saudi army, for example, with some of their problems and so on, we've been advising some of the other armed forces in the Gulf region.
Well, now, what sort of problems were the Saudi army having? Were they getting something similar to the Gulf War illness, or would this just be from toxic chemicals there?
Well, they had some of it, certainly not at the same incidence level that the British and American and Canadian forces that served in the Gulf had, but they did have some illness, and they were very concerned about that. It's hard to know the exact numbers because they're very secretive about these kinds of things in the Arab world.
All right, but then they did, of course, ask your input, and you would have suggested that the immune enhancers, would that be your first line of approach to it?
Well, we were helping them trying to, again, unravel these different problems that they had in terms of exposures and so on. And they were trying to set up a testing laboratory, for example, to test for some of the chronic infections there and a few different things like that, test for heavy metal exposures and so on. So they were interested in doing some of the things that, that we and other groups that are interested in these illnesses are doing. So I don't know the full extent of it because we were only involved in a very small part of it.
Well, do you think our military, at least on this occasion, will use antibiotics much more so? My understanding was that during the Gulf War there were antibiotics there, but they were not used.
Well, they did bury in the sand these huge pallets of antibiotics. It's very interesting because one of the people that worked for a generic pharmaceutical company contacted me after the war and said, "Gee, you know what? Just before the war, there were orders for millions and millions of units of doxycycline, and we were told to deliver this to an Air Force base, which we did. They put it on a pallet and shipped it immediately to Saudi Arabia. And some of these things ended up after the war being buried in the sand. And we know that took place because one of the people involved in burying them actually took a souvenir, that is a box of the antibiotics, back with him, and sure enough, it was doxycycline. So they knew all along that this was a way to treat the illnesses that were expected from the Gulf War. They just didn't let people in on it.
And, of course, the interesting thing is the French, were much more concerned, and they did not give the multiple vaccines. They actually gave their troops the doxycycline, and relatively few of them have any serious sequelae?
That's correct. And we're interested to know in the French forces of the few cases that they had, if these cases were French officers that served with American and British units, because they would have been forced to take the vaccines just like anyone else. So I still haven't gotten my reply back from the Ministry of Defense in France to see if that's the situation. I don't know whether they've really studied it carefully. But again, as I mentioned before in the last segment, I believe, of your show, they had very few casualties, and one of the reasons for that is they used prophylactic antibiotics, doxycycline, in many cases, rather than the vaccines, multiple vaccines, to protect against biological warfare agents.
Well, of course, now we've given many of our troops anthrax vaccine, and now they've got the smallpox vaccine. In fact, they were giving a lot of these young men the vaccines on their way over, so there was no way they could object to it. Have they been hitting them with as many vaccines as they did before the Gulf War, or do we know that?
Well, I imagine they are. Again, these are things that they're keeping secret these days, but I imagine they're getting just as many vaccines, possibly even more than before. One difference is they're trying to immunize them actually before they leave for the Gulf now, instead of giving them all at once after they arrive. That was just horrible what they did in the last Gulf War, which was give them within a 2 or 3 day period after their arrival in the Gulf theater of operations. And this was very immune suppressing. Now they're trying to space it out a little bit better, which is less damaging to your immune system. But again, it all depends on how they do it.
Right, and I know my son certainly was over there, and he was subjected to all sorts of shots. You know, he wasn't in the Gulf War. He was on a carrier, and he was there about 6 months before the Gulf War. But, they were just giving shots every time he turned around, and he developed just terrible, terrible allergies and almost died of acute respiratory arrest, developed asthma. And the only thing we can imagine is it was related to just multiple shots. Is this something you hear from people who've been in the military who are not necessarily serving in the Gulf itself?
Oh, yes. In fact, it's one of the major problems in the anthrax vaccine program is that anywhere from 7 to 17% of the people that receive the anthrax vaccine come down with some chronic problem afterwards. And again, the way that this is being monitored is very poor, and it's actually, they're being told not to complain about it if you have chronic problems. Physicians are told not to report any chronic problem unless you're hospitalized within 48 hours. It's not even listed as any relationship to the anthrax vaccine, but there are some real terrible problems. And we just published a paper in the Journal of Nutritional and Environmental Medicine on this, and this is the official journal of the American Academy of Environmental Medicine. And for those that are interested, you can go to our website and download that paper. But I discuss in great detail, along with Dr. Merrill Nass, an anthrax expert, the vaccine and the effects of the vaccine and the problems associated with the vaccine. And these illnesses are a major problem.
And what was the incidence of reaction to that again?
Again, anywhere from 7 to 17% of the forces receiving those vaccines had some kind of reaction. And in some cases, this led to long-term chronic illness. And in other cases, even death. More people have died from the anthrax vaccine than have died from anthrax. So this is something that's not trivial.
No, it certainly isn't. And I'm so glad that you're on top of that. And, of course, we've had Dr. Nass on a number of times, and she's certainly a very courageous woman. I want to thank you so very much for being with us this evening. Do you have any parting thoughts for our listeners?
Well, I think the important thing is information. We're still a free society, still, hopefully, and the information is there. Please get the information out. We provide a lot of it on our website, certainly in the area of chronic infections and their role in chronic illnesses. There's a lot of information at www.immed.org, that's immediate.org, from the Institute for Molecular Medicine. Use that information and take it to your physicians.
Well, thank you so very much for being with us, Dr. Nicholson. It's amazing how fast that 2 hours does go, but I appreciate it, and interview will go out to many of our listeners across America, even those who aren't listening tonight. So thank you so much for being with us.
Well, I appreciate being on your show.
Good night. Bye-bye. Well, this is Dr. Garth Nicholson. I hope you enjoyed our interview with him. It's always a pleasure. You're getting certainly cutting-edge information. And, of course, this is the time we ask you to pray for our boys going into battle and for their families and for the civilians over there and for the Iraqi soldiers as well. Let's hope and pray this war will be short with as little possible death as possible. And please remember to pray for Radio Liberty, for our provision and our protection.
Couple hours.
Is that fascinating?